When are people going to see that nothing ain't never going to change unless somebody finally makes up its mind to stand up and fight? Damn.
Netroots Radio presents Hopping Mad with Will McLeod and Arliss Bunny. Now, here's Will and Arliss.
Welcome to Hopping Mad. I'm Will McLeod. Arliss will be with us shortly. Today we're doing an in-depth show on Dodd-Frank and financial regulation. This is what Arliss has been working towards. We're pleased to welcome Alexis Goldstein of Americans for Financial Reform to talk in-depth about banking regulation, what isn't being done, and what needs to be done. In order to have that conversation, we needed to break through the obfuscation, jargon, and disinformation to get to the facts. That's why Arliss has been working so hard on these topics. And today comes the big conversation that we've been leading up to. But first, I have two pieces of news. There's a little bit of disinformation I want to deal with regarding the election. Bernie held a town hall at the Twin Arrows Navajo Casino and Resort on Friday, March 17th. The Navajo government, headed by President Russell Begay, rolled out the red carpet. Begay and Sanders sat together and spoke about issues affecting the Navajo, and following that, Begay, his vice president, and the CEO of the casino introduced Sanders before his town hall event, laying out a number of issues that affect the Navajo and other First Nations. From all accounts, especially Begay's, the conversation went extremely well. Begay described the visit in glowing terms, saying that Sanders had a clear grasp of the issues affecting Native peoples. In addition, Begay called for a cabinet-level position with the authority to cut across multiple federal agencies to deal with the issues faced by Native peoples. He asked that government-to-government relationships between the federal government and Native governments be respected and understood as relationships between sovereign entities. He also called on the government to honor their treaties with Native peoples and their governments. Begay stopped short of a full endorsement, however. This was a wise strategic move on his part. In his remarks, he encouraged other candidates to visit the Navajo Nation in order to speak with them about these issues. Begay was clearly attempting to draw maximum attention to the state of emergency that affects First Nations in the modern day. We've reported on this program before about dioxin contamination on the San Carlos Apache Reservation. Similar issues affect the Navajo. The Animas River, which flows through Navajo land, was devastated when toxic waste was released from the Gold King mine. More than 3 million gallons of contaminated water flowed downstream. The river is still contaminated by elevated levels of arsenic and lead, with levels of both spiking each time there's a major storm. Begay has been sharply critical of the Obama administration and the EPA over what they have called inaction on the Animas River. Environmental racism is not the only issue affecting the Navajo. Poor infrastructure and a weak economy are both difficult to deal with. When I called the landline of the Navajo government, the connection was so weak that I couldn't hear most of what was being said on the other side. I had to dial someone on their personal line in order to talk about this story. Clearly, investment in infrastructures need to be made. In an odd twist, the internet is buzzing that Begay came out and endorsed the senator. That is simply not the case, and both the Bernie camp and the Navajo government seem to be mystified as to why this is being claimed at all. I spoke to Mihi Omanis, the press officer for the president, who noted that this question had been asked several times. He indicated that while the senator and president had a very good conversation, President Begay had not endorsed any presidential candidates at this time. The Bernie campaign doesn't appear to have claimed in any way that President Begay endorsed Bernie. Neither does the Navajo government seem to have indicated any kind of endorsement. But this is an age of internet politics. It seems an overzealous supporter of Bernie's made this claim online, at which point it was spread uncritically by supporters of the senator. This is dangerous and potentially damaging. The Navajo are intent on being heard. They would like a cabinet-level appointment for Native peoples, they would like the federal government to respect the sovereignty of Native governments, and honor the treaties it has made. Furthermore, the Sanders campaign wanted to highlight the economic injustice on Native lands, and to speak about issues affecting Native Americans. Disinformation that causes a squabble about who actually endorsed who could be both harmful to the Navajo by drowning out their fight for justice with a squabble over the primary, and harmful for Bernie, by taking an instance where Bernie was actively working to highlight Native issues and making it look like cheap pandering. In the age of internet politics, we need to do two things. First, be critical of information before we share it, making sure that the stuff we're tweeting, sharing on Facebook, or reblogging is actually factual. Second, we need to follow the example set by the Navajo people and by President Begay. When confronted by a pointlessly dramatic situation, they have stayed out of the fray and focused on talking about the issues that matter. That being said, this has been a consistent problem for the Sanders campaign, both with junior staffers and with online supporters. New Hampshire for Bernie used photographs of Thomas Wiley, a member of the American Legion. Now, Wiley, as a member of the American Legion, is from a nonpartisan organization. A photo of him was used in a campaign mailer, despite having been assured otherwise by the Bernie campaign. The campaign apologized, saying it was an accident that should never have happened. In New Hampshire again, the Nashua Telegraph and Valley News were both forced to announce that they had not endorsed Bernie Sanders, because a campaign ad from Sanders implied that they had. This has been a consistent problem with the messy politics of the Bernie campaign. And while those of us who are Democrats are willing to forgive mistakes like this, each instance has been used as a method to attack the Sanders campaign, sometimes unfairly. As progressive and grassroots politics move forward, we need to figure out how to avoid these situations and prevent this kind of squabbling so that we can continue to focus on the issues that matter. Thankfully, in this situation, no kind of squabble or fight has been started. I'm hoping that by highlighting the issues that the Navajo want discussed, as well as highlighting the work done by Bernie to cover economic equality on Native reservations, we can keep it that way, and keep the conversation where it needs to be, on the issues that matter, and not on divisiveness within the process of our primary politics. While disinformation can distract us from important issues, silence is often worse. In late February, three young men from Muslim families were gunned down execution style in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Mohammed Taha Omar, who was 23, and Muhannad Tayrab, who was 17, were both Muslims, while 20-year-old Adam Mekki was Christian. All of them were of West African heritage. Activists have worked hard to pierce the veil of silence surrounding these deaths, with national media paying very little attention to the situation. I only discovered this incident in the past week, nearly a month after the murders occurred. Even the left-wing spaces I occupy rang with silence about the incident. The situation is murky. The three were murdered at a local hangout spot for young people, and the police have released very few details on the incident. While the police have said none of these young men appear to have been involved with gangs or organized crime, several news outlets have insinuated that they were. Similarly, while the police have ruled the incident not likely to be a hate crime, the silence and dismissal surrounding the murders is indicative of rising Islamophobia in the United States and already extant racism. Contrast the lack of coverage in this case with the lack of coverage of the murder of three young Muslim students at Chapel Hill, North Carolina, last February. While that story got wider coverage, it was still poorly covered. Hicks, the murderer, had apparently threatened the youth multiple times, and when he carried out an act of premeditated murder, the news implied that it was because of a dispute over a parking space. It's apparently never about race or religion when Muslims are gunned down in cold blood in the United States. They insinuated that Hicks murdered the three in that parking space dispute, just like they insinuated that in this case it was because of gang affiliations, even though the police themselves deny those affiliations. I've read multiple accounts saying that the house in question was known for gang activity. When the police disputed that, the news organizations making that claim ignored the police, and to date have issued no retractions. The news media is implying that these victims of crime have done something to trigger their own murders. Refusing to give way to Hicks over a parking space, causing Hicks to overreact. Being affiliated with shady characters, or hanging out on an abandoned property in the Indiana murder case. Allow me to dispel this nonsense. Teenagers and 20-somethings claim unused spaces for their own. People who don't own a handful of earth themselves are happy to claim spaces that others have abandoned. In my neighborhood growing up, it was the parking lot of an abandoned medical complex. The complex itself was locked up so tightly that nobody could get in, otherwise we definitely would have gone inside, being teenagers. But the parking lot was always empty and shaded with old-growth trees, so it became a place for everyone from teenagers to even grade schoolers to ride bikes or skateboard. While in urban areas it's abandoned spaces, in rural areas it's the woods. Youth there claim empty patches of forest, especially if there is an old abandoned Boy Scout facility, or a pond, or a beach, or a closed-down youth camp. When I worked at a summer camp in college, I remember finding some of the disused buildings way out in the scrub forest on the northern side of the camp. They were full of spider webs and high school graffiti dating back to the early 90s. It was typical teenage stuff. Who was dating who they thought was awful, how much they hated the football team, and the rest of the world outside their group. There was no harm in it. To date, those cabins still haven't been used. No one's touched them since the 70s, except for that group of teenagers. There's nothing unusual or wrong with these young people doing what young people everywhere around the world do, being at an abandoned space. There's no reason why they shouldn't have been where they were, or feared that they would be murdered as a result of it. And there's no reason why the media shouldn't cover this tragedy for the tragedy it is, instead of trying to find some reason why these young men deserved to be murdered, and being silent when that reason can't be found. Black lives matter. Black Muslim lives matter. We shouldn't play hunt for the reason to blame the victim or be completely silent when black Americans or Muslims are murdered. We should recognize that in many of these shootings, race and religion do play a part. We should recognize that in the coverage of these incidents, race and religion are going to play a part. And we've got to do better in informing America about what's happening to vulnerable Americans. Coming up on Hopping Mad, Arliss is going to give an in-depth breakdown on Dodd-Frank and financial regulation, followed by our interview with Alexis Goldstein. Stay tuned.
They broke me across the back. By a name I'm known, and it's not my own. They call me Crooked Jack. Now the ganger's blue-eyed boy was I. Big Jack could do no wrong, and the reason simply was because I could work hard hours and long. I was tall and true, all of 6'2", but they broke me across the back. By a name I'm known, and it's not my own. They call me Crooked Jack.
We're back on Hopping Mad. I really want you to strap yourselves in, because all that prep work we've done for the last several weeks on derivatives and kinds of futures trading and all the different markets, you're going to need all that information today when we go ahead and talk about the legislation that applies to securities trading. I want to start with history. I want to start with the Glass-Steagall Banking Act of 1933. It was part of FDR's New Deal. It set up things like the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC, and most importantly, it created a wall between commercial banks and investment banks. The intention was to engender stability and to end banking panics, and it was very successful at doing that. But even more importantly, it was intended to establish the U.S. banking system worldwide as a stable, transparent, and trustworthy banking structure, impelling investment in the U.S. economy. And it obviously did that. The other thing to know about Glass-Steagall was that it wasn't one piece of legislation. Glass-Steagall itself was, but then for the next 5 or 6 years, every year there was a new banking regulatory act. Glass-Steagall was part of an iterative process, and that actually then continued on even from there all the way to the Bank Holding Act of 1956, which, just as Glass-Steagall did, only with two different industries, created a wall between banking and insurance. So all of that was fine. There were basically holes opening up in it, but Glass-Steagall was holding up and valuable in many ways until it was thoroughly neutered in 1999 by President Clinton when he signed into being the Financial Modernization Act, aka Gramm-Leash-Bliley. And the thing I found most interesting when I was doing this sort of historical look back were the senators who opposed Gramm-Leash-Bliley, including Barbara Boxer, Paul Wellstone, Barbara Mikulski, Tom Harkin, Russ Feingold, Richard Bryan, Byron Drogan, sort of the who's who of left-leaning senators. So when people say that they didn't see what was possible or how bad it could get, I'm sorry, these guys did. These guys knew. So the left has known for a long time that getting rid of Glass-Steagall was going to be seriously problematic. And indeed, that proved to be the case. However, we can't just pat ourselves on the back, because Glass-Steagall would likely not have prevented the global financial crisis of 2007. Glass-Steagall did not regulate shadow banking at all. So, for instance, AIG would have fallen outside of Glass-Steagall. The fall of Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, and later Merrill Lynch would have happened just as they did, because under Glass-Steagall, investment banks with no commercial banking business, not regulated. Derivative insanity, including CDOs, CDSs, synthetic derivative instruments, would still have been allowed under Glass-Steagall. And rating agencies, and this is something Will and I just really emphasized, rating agencies would still have had fatal conflicts of interest under Glass-Steagall. Incentivized subprime mortgage underwriting would still have been allowable. So all of these things would still have happened. The difference is that Glass-Steagall would have limited the thirst for subprime loans, because banks could only have been on one side of the deal. They couldn't have been both the commercial bank and the investment bank. They couldn't have essentially gone short against themselves. And banks would have been smaller. Without the mergers that were allowed by Glass-Steagall, banks would have been smaller, and smaller would have been less dangerous to the overall health and well-being of the U.S. economy. Elizabeth Warren has said an interesting thing about Glass-Steagall, and to paraphrase, basically, she thinks that Glass-Steagall as a convenient meme is valuable, but that really much more is needed now. And that's why, instead of talking about bringing back Glass-Steagall, we need to be talking about a 21st century Glass-Steagall, because it's really a whole new universe of laws, much bigger, much broader, a much more substantial set of legislation. Now into Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank is the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. It was passed on the 21st of July, 2010. And it was intended to increase the security of consumers, investors, and small businesses, aka Main Street, in particular. And we think of Dodd-Frank in terms of the limitations, in terms of the things that haven't gotten into place yet, even though it's 6 years later. We think of Dodd-Frank in terms of failures, but actually Dodd-Frank has had a number of successes. And we need to also be aware that we have made progress. Hope is important. And if we don't acknowledge that we have come some distance, we don't realize that we can get where we want to go. So on the day Dodd-Frank was signed into law, the top financial services lobbyist in Washington, D.C. said, "Now it's halftime." And that has indeed proven to be the case, because in 2012, lobbyists outnumbered consumer advocates by 20-1. On financial services issues. Banks have spent hundreds of millions of dollars fighting Dodd-Frank, and they continue to work at it every day, including today. That's just, it is the way it is. So one of the things that I think I was most surprised about in doing all of this research is that Washington gridlock has actually served a valuable purpose, a valuable role in the last couple of years, because so little legislation has passed in Congress. There's so much gridlock. It's such a disaster that it has been impossible to attach poison pill amendments to very many things. A couple things have gotten through, but not very many. And that's simply because there's so little legislation moving that there's just not capacity to carry enough poison pills. And part of that process is that we really do need to thank Congressman Maxine Waters of California. She serves as the ranking member on the House Financial Services Committee, and she has basically been body blocking most of the anti-Dodd-Frank legislation. She's a tremendous advocate for all of us, and we all owe her our thanks. Now let me start talking about sections of Dodd-Frank. And I'm going to start with the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, because that's the one that really we can see and feel the most. It is an independent federal entity housed within, but not supervised by, the Federal Reserve. And its sole directive is to protect consumers against unfair, deceptive, and illegal practices by lenders. It is funded as a percentage of the Federal Reserve's budget, and the Federal Reserve is self-funded. So there is no way for Congress to cut off money to the CFPB, which is one of the great values of the CFPB overall. It's safe from congressional meddling. The CFPB has done a number of things which are invaluable. They have, for instance, the authority to write and enforce rules for private sector lenders. And one of the obvious examples of that is the qualified mortgage rule, what's called the QM rule, which prevents subprime mortgage lending. There now has to be things like means testing, things that should always have been going on and most of us thought was going on, but wasn't actually going on. There's a new private student loan ombudsman and a private loan shopping sheet for student loans, which are now used by more than 2,000 colleges and universities. Agencies which regulate small banks are required to use applicable CFPB rules, and the CFPB is working on building out a lot of the supervision and rules of those banks and other related small financial services entities. Forced arbitration in residential mortgages is banned, and forced arbitration in other areas can be banned should the CFPB so determine. The CFPB has done things like regulate credit and debit card swipe fees, and they've also put in place things like Ask the CFPB, an interactive database. And by the way, I went online, I took a look at it. It's amazing. Go there, look. It's absolutely incredible. You should see it. They also have CFPB in Espanol, which obviously critical. And they're at work right now. Their biggest project right now are new rules for payday lending and debt collection. So those guys are living on a short leash. In terms of enforcement and supervision, they have provided $10.1 billion in relief to a total of 17 million consumers. Those include things like refunds for credit card add-on products, service members who were harmed by predatory lending, and those of us who were harmed by unfair billing practices in any number of ways. The next section I'm going to talk about for Dodd-Frank are credit ratings agencies, CRAs. The goal of Dodd-Frank was to end the conflict of interest, which long existed for ratings agencies. And Will and I really unloaded on that last week. But rating agencies now have, among other things, an explicit duty to report violations of law to appropriate authorities. You would have thought that that was, you know, a normal thing, but you would be wrong. The SEC now has an Office of Credit Ratings, so they have a particular focus now on credit ratings agencies. And the SEC is mandated to examine and audit practices of ratings agencies, and most importantly, to report on them. The SEC has to say what's happening and how successful a ratings agency has been. CRA compliance officers within the ratings agencies, their compensation can in no way be tied to the financial performance of the firm, and it is mandated that they be provided absolute independence. Transparency. Ratings agencies are required to disclose performance, you know, how successful their rating was, how accurate it was on a given security, as well as the data they used to get there and the methodology. Raters must now be trained and tested. You would have, again, thought this would have been a normal thing, but no. And investors, finally, investors are able to recover damages for gross negligence in ratings. In other words, you can now sue Standard & Poor's. So, derivatives. This is the next big section. Derivatives are now handled in clearinghouses, or most of them are. 75% of derivatives now clear through clearinghouses, similar to the Chicago Board of Trade or the NYSE, only for derivatives. That mandate for clearing was rolled out in 2013, and swaps, in particular, reduced from clearing once a day, or in some cases once a week, to having 99% of them clear in 10 seconds or less. And what that does is dramatically decrease the credit risk. It decreases the ability of traders to float. And regulators have access to what was formerly private information on swaps trades, and swaps traders are required to post a margin, just as futures traders do. And we talked about that, I think, 3 weeks ago. For the other 25% of the swaps market, the CFTC proposed a new margin rule in 2011, but that rule came up against what was then the Basel III process, the international process. And basically, the CFTC had to pull back their rule and wait for Basel III to complete and then issue a new rule that was Basel III compliant. That's now been done and it's in place. So one of the tricky things about swap regulation is that it has to be inclusive of what's going on internationally because these things trade in a borderless way. The other thing that's happened in the swaps market is that additional standards and disclosures are required when the customer is a pension fund or a municipality. And Will, this is something you had brought up talking about the city of Detroit, for instance.
Yeah, when you have a situation where if you are Detroit and you put all of your money into these AAA rated things from Standard & Poor's that are actually great big bags of, you know, crap, but you didn't know that, you're trusting Standard & Poor's, you can end up bankrupt. And so everyone's coming down on Detroit for mismanagement. The only way that Detroit mismanaged themselves was by trusting Standard & Poor's. I am still livid about this, but Arliss, you're on a roll, so I'm going to let you keep taking this.
So the next thing I'm going to touch on just super quickly is executive pay. And this is one of the areas where Mary Jo White and Elizabeth Warren really came up against each other and sort of duked it out. But after a long delay, the SEC has finally managed to issue the applicable rules around this. But the goal was to tie executive incentives to long-term stability as opposed to short-term stability. And that not only stabilizes our economy, but I think that it makes us more attractive as an investment for nations that tend to look farther down the line. One of the exceptions about the U.S. economy is that we were so quarterly driven. And these new executive pay rules sort of run contra to that. So we'll see how that nets out as time, you know, as we go forward in time. Stock exchanges must now establish executive pay compensation committees. They're trying to bring some of the practices on executive pay into the light. And what's called a clawback must be in place to take guaranteed and already paid compensation back if it's later determined that required financial information had been misstated. In other words, if an executive signs off on something that indicates a certain amount of profitability and it turns out that was wrong, there have to be clawback provisions in that executive's contract. And so the relationship between executive performance and compensation must be disclosed by compensation committees, as well as the ratio between executive compensation and the median employee compensation, as per rules finally set by the SEC this past August. Now I'm going to hit investor protections. Because so many investors were taken unaware and have lost trust in the system, in other words, they did not see the global financial crisis coming, Dodd-Frank strives to layer protections to provide for the reestablishment of trust. And note that many investor lawsuits are still running. They're still ongoing. The SEC now has the authority to mandate, and I'm sorry, but this just should have been the case. It's the case in almost every other country in the world but ours. The SEC now, finally, has the authority to mandate that the fiduciary duty of your investment advisor is to you and not to the company whose securities the investment advisor is selling to you. And mandatory arbitration for securities has been prohibited. It's not legal anymore. New rules are related to third-party verification of custody of assets. So somebody always knows where assets are. And awards are also now being provided for whistleblowers. There's an investment advisory committee, which probably isn't powerful enough inside the SEC now. And there are special protections for senior investors. But then you get to another one of the biggies, and that is systemic risk. And this is when I talk about the Volcker rule, or in the UK, they talk about this. And in fact, in the EU, they talk about this and use the term ring fence. Ring fencing, or the Volcker rule, prevent banks from investing in risky instruments like derivatives with taxpayer-backed money. They create a financial environment intended to push banks away from investing in unicorns and into investing in Main Street and families. No activity can be deemed permitted if it would result in a conflict of interest for the banking entity involved, result in exposure of the banking entity to high-risk assets or trading strategies, and pose a threat to the stability of the banking entity. So there's something called a prohibition on proprietary trading. Remember that term, proprietary trading, also called prop trading. Prop trading is a bank using its own money and not that of a depositor or an investor to make a trade in a security. Under the Volcker Rule, a banking entity cannot engage in proprietary trading, own an entity that participates in proprietary trading, but of course, there are exceptions, and therein lies the rub. It took 5 years to get the better part of five years to get the Volcker Rule implemented, because that's what they were fighting about. They were fighting about where the exceptions were, where the lines are drawn inside the Volcker Rule. Under the Volcker Rule, a non-bank financial company which engages in prop trading is subject to the same capital requirements and quantitative limits that banks are. So basically, everybody has to play by the same rules. One of the areas where there's still work to be done is in what's called capital requirements. Oversight agencies need to adopt additional capital requirements and quantitative limits, and those numbers need to be set in stone. That really hasn't been done as strongly or as firmly as we would all like. It's part of the process. Getting the Volcker Rule in place was supposed to take no more than 2 years. It took almost five. And by the way, while that was going on, the white belly of our financial system was laid bare that entire time. And a lot of deals and a lot of instruments were put in place during that period of time that now are grandfathered in for at least another 2 year period of time. Then we get to something called, and this is one of the really powerful things that Dodd-Frank did. This is one of the things Dodd-Frank got really right. It put in place something called the Financial Stability Oversight Council, or FSOC. The FSOC brings together all the regulators into a collective body and develops rules to unite and direct various agency regulators in the same direction. Voting members include the heads of Treasury, the Fed, the OCC, the SEC, the CFPB, the CFTC, and the FDIC, among others. And if you understood that whole acronym salad, you're a rock star. This FSOC monitors and regulates systemic risk. So the FSOC has brought all the players into one room, all the regulation players into one room, and they're monitoring systemic risk. That's what they're looking for. And their other primary goal is to limit and eliminate, basically bail out expectations by industry. So something that I didn't realize was going to be difficult and turned out to be difficult was creating tools for all these people to work together, because all these regulating agencies hadn't worked together in the past. Now we're going to get to something really dangerous. There's something called the Swaps Pushout Rule that was also called the Lincoln Provision. And the Swaps Pushout Rule was the thing that required banks to separate their holdings into two buckets, a normal vanilla bucket of banking, regular normal banking assets, and a separate bucket where they put all the swaps, all the dangerous stuff. So the FDIC would insure and back the vanilla bucket, and the other bucket, banks were left to hang on that. Well, as anybody who has followed me on the after show knows, the swap pushout rule was repealed in the 2014 Cromnibus, and it remains that way to this day. So essentially, as long as we don't have a swaps pushout rule, we have a government subsidy for derivatives trading. The Fed has now established under bank risk, the Fed's established standards for capital requirements, leverage limits, liquidity requirements, and most importantly, something called living wills. A living will is when a large bank must show how they can be taken apart in a manner which doesn't disrupt the entire financial system. And banks have now, under this orderly acquisition authority and the living wills, they have submitted their living wills to the Fed, and the Fed has rejected a number of them. The Fed has said, nope, not good enough, and sent them back. Additionally, the Fed has required higher capital reserve to cover all off-balance sheet debt, which is basically new. And they are also requiring systemically important financial institutions. Those guys are required. Those are the big top banks. They're required to hold now $1 in capital for every $15 in debt that they have, which is better than before. And as we get close to the end here, there are a couple of things that are important to know. The Fed has now new stress testing regimes, which means that they can go into a bank and test their capital requirements on a point in time basis. And I'll be talking to our guest about that in a few minutes. minutes. And there are risk retention rules, which means that the securitizers are now required to retain 5% of every security they write. They can't just package these CDOs together and then dump them all off. They have to hang on to some of them. There are due diligence requirements now for securities, and regulators have the freedom to evolve their roles and to evolve as new derivatives emerge. There's a ton of other detail on this. The Fed, for instance, can no longer lend to individual troubled companies as a matter of law. That ostensibly ends too big to fail. As a matter of function, that's another whole thing. And the Fed has survived a one-time audit by the GAO on their lending habits during the global financial crisis. And the Fed discount window lending is now audited on a regular basis. Fed loans have to be paid back, those kinds of things. So there have been an enormous number of changes, but there's still a long way to go. And coming up, Alexis Goldstein is a writer and activist who was very involved in Occupy, and particularly Occupy the SEC. And currently, she's serving as the senior policy analyst for Americans for Financial Reform, which is a nonpartisan coalition of over 200 organizations working for a safe and ethical financial system. Alexis runs the website becausefinanceisboring.com and has a personal website at alexisgo.com. She's a member of the Debt Collective and is the co-host of 3 podcasts, including Humorless Queers, Criticize After Dinner, and the occasional but really, really wonderful podcast, Disorderly Conduct. My very favorite thing about Alexis is that she's the co-author of Occupy the SEC's 325-page comment letter urging the SEC to implement a strong Volcker rule, which we just talked about a few minutes ago. Basically, Alexis is a Dodd-Frank god, and we are incredibly happy to have her with us here today. So, Alexis, there are 6 companies in the financial securities industry that comprise something like 7% of our gross domestic product, our income, but about 60% of the assets of our economy. Would you talk to us a bit about systemically important financial institutions, too big to fail and too interconnected to fail? And shouldn't we be seeing more emphasis on the latter?
Absolutely. So those are 3 very big questions. So I'll try to take them in order. So systemically important financial institutions, which I will, if you will forgive me, refer to as SIFIs from now on, which yeah. is what bank dorks like me refer to them as, is a part of Dodd-Frank. And basically, the Republicans for a long time have been trying to say that this part of Dodd-Frank enshrines too big to fail, because you get this stamp which says that you're a SIFI, and that means that we'll bail you out no matter what, which is completely untrue, for the record. All a SIFI designation really means is that we're going to have increased oversight of you and watch you more carefully, which makes perfect sense to me. But actually, the SIFI designation is something that a lot of companies have been trying desperately to avoid. So one of them is MetLife, who at first sued over their SIFI designation and then basically just decided, you know what, we're just going to break up ourselves voluntarily so we don't become a SIFI. And then there was GE, which prior to recently, most of their profits, a huge chunk of their profits came from their financial arm, which was called GE Financial.
Right.
And they've decided to sell that off so that they don't get the SIFI designation. So SIFIs are just meant for a way for the regulators to be able to have a bit more oversight and a bit more tools in their toolkit in order to make sure that there aren't people that aren't banks that aren't being monitored that kind of cause huge risks to the financial system. But that doesn't really necessarily help us with the second part of your question, which is too big to fail. So Elizabeth Warren likes to talk about how the too big to fail banks are larger now than they were during the financial crisis. And that is true.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about this is there's sort of an internal debate, I would say, between the advocate community and perhaps some people in Congress and at regulators, and then what I would call maybe the status quo inside the regulators. So Dodd-Frank actually says, if you are too big to go through bankruptcy without the government helping you, you are too big to fail, and the Fed can essentially take steps to break you up or force you to break yourself up.
Which is what Hillary Clinton is referring to when she keeps coming back and saying, we can already go into, Dodd-Frank already gives us the tools to go in and break these guys up if we need to.
That's true. I would only quibble with that slightly to say it's not that Dodd-Frank gives us the tools. It's that Dodd-Frank directs the regulators to do that.
Yes, you're
and
right.
So, yeah. Clinton seems to kind of be implying, oh, I will be different and I will make the regulators use the tools. But what's happening right now, in my opinion, is the regulators are not obeying the law. the law says if a bank is too big to go through bankruptcy, you know, we need to take certain steps. And what's been happening is the Fed has been basically slow walking the long process that leads to the breakup. So this is part of what's called the living wills part of Dodd-Frank. And what's supposed to happen is you submit your living will, and the living will is like what proves that you can go through bankruptcy, essentially. And if it fails, then there are certain steps that can happen after that. And, you know, maybe two steps down that chain is we can eventually ask you to break yourself up. And what's been happening is the Fed has basically been, people have been submitting their living wills, and the Fed has been like, you would fail, so here's how you fix it so you don't fail. And then they submit again, and they're like, okay, you still don't quite have it, so here's how you fix
it. Know the Fed kicked back like RBS's. I mean, they failed RBS, didn't they?
I don't actually recall what happened with RBS. I do know that there's been some disagreement between the Fed and the FDIC on some of the even larger banks. And it seems like the FDIC is basically saying, we don't think even, say, like Citigroup or Bank of America's plans are reasonable. Well, but the Fed hasn't been willing to.
Because they can't be, right? I mean, honestly, those banks are so big that there's nothing they could put into, in my opinion, for the little I know, there's nothing they could put in a living will that says if they went down in flames, the economy isn't going to be hit. Because they're too big.
Right.
I mean,
is there any kind of civil litigation that we could carry out to kind of force the Fed to do its job here?
Yeah, I don't know about litigation. I mean, there's certainly like citizen petitions have been tried in the past, and they actually were tried with a different part of Dodd-Frank, but Public Citizen had an interesting petition to the Fed in the past about Section 121 of Dodd-Frank, which is about things being too systemically risky. But you could, I suppose, do another sort of citizen petition like they did with that and say, you know what, the Fed, you need to really act. What are you imagining, though? I'm curious, in terms of litigation. Maybe it's a strategy we haven't thought of yet.
Well, I'm very much a layman here, so I was thinking that there was some kind of litigation that we could take out of citizens demanding action on certain things. We are allowed by the Constitution to petition the government for a redress of grievances. I'm wondering if the case law just hasn't been written for suing the government for not doing its job.
Well, it's interesting. You know what? Like, Occupy the SEC, after I sort of hadn't been involved anymore, sort of tried this. They tried to sue, I think, all of the regulators for not implementing the Volcker Rule, not finishing it. It has since been finished, but they weren't considered to have standing, which is sort of like some legal, but I'm not an attorney either, but my understanding is you have to have this magical standing, somebody that's actually impacted by the regulation in order to sue. And usually that means like the bank being regulated, and this group of citizens wasn't considered to have standing, which is ridiculous, but that was the, that would be my concern with that tactic, is it may not work, but that doesn't mean, you know,
that we shouldn't try it.
It
can at least be a moral victory. And what, real quick, you mentioned RBS earlier, and that brings up, we talked to Francis Coppola last week. And what's on my mind of all this is we have banks in the U.S. that do business internationally. We have RBS that does business here. Has there been any kind of stress testing related to Brexit?
You know, they're pretty quiet about what they're doing with the stress test. It's a very opaque process. This is something that has been criticized in the past, both stress testing and living wills, the whole procedure. Mm. Like Elizabeth Warren has brought this up in, I forget if it was last year or when, but in a Senate banking hearing, and she was talking about how, you know, Janet Yellen admitted that there were some, you know, thousands and thousands of pages of submissions for the living will. And Elizabeth Warren was like, that's so interesting that you mentioned that, because the public has only seen 30 pages of it.
Yes, I love that moment. That was precious. Yeah.
So the answer to your question is, I just don't know.
So the people's right to know, and as far as the stuff is being, you know, concerned, is really being sort of taken over.
Let's get back to too interconnected to fail, because I think we have limited time, and I don't want to lose that thread.
Okay.
So too interconnected to fail is one of the parts of Dodd-Frank that really hasn't been finished yet, in my opinion. So in section 165 of Dodd-Frank, there's a portion that talks about single counterparty credit limits. So the way that you can think about this is, if I'm Morgan Stanley and Arliss is JP Morgan, there are certain limits on the amount of exposure that I can have to Arliss. Because if it's too high, then I'm going to have a problem if Arliss goes under, right? Or I'm going to have a problem if I have a huge amount of exposure to Will. And that is a part of Dodd-Frank that has not been finished yet. So I think that that problem is, and certainly I wouldn't say that that is the only way to fix too interconnected to fail. I think, you know, we have heard a lot in the election about the shadow banking system. And when they talk about that, they mean, you know, things like repo, which is, I like to think of it as a pawn shop, right? Like, how can you get some short-term lending quickly? And as an individual, how do you do that? You go to the pawn shop and you say, I'm going to, you know, temporarily sell you this watch and you're going to give me a loan and then I'm going to come back and buy it back from you. But big banks conduct that through using all of their different securities. So that's another part of the market that I think there are I think it's actually two banks, the Bank of New York Mellon and JP Morgan, that basically control the entire repo market.
Yeah, they're the two clearing banks.
Right. So that is something that, in my opinion, hasn't been addressed at all by Dodd-Frank or otherwise, although the Fed has certainly been writing a lot of white papers about it. So those are just two examples of things that continue to create risks in terms of too interconnected to fail.
I wrote what turned out to be an enormously successful blog post and then am now at work on a book on what happened to the Fed, what happened at the Fed during 9/11. And part of that was, of course, dealing with those two clearing banks and having the entire repo market basically having gone up in flames, quite literally, the danger that presented to the U.S. economy was tremendous. So that Mellon basically has relocated their clearing center to Florida, is supposed to help break up the risk, except that, of course, Florida goes underwater periodically. So I'm not sure that they chose their location particularly cleverly. You know, even things like that, literally physical disasters can bring down, can put the economy at incredible risk in, you know, a 10-minute period of time. It can be that fast that everything falls apart.
It's interesting. So there's all these pieces that we're trying to use in order to make the system safer. And it is my opinion, and I think the opinion of the organization that I work for, that we need to try a lot of different things. And there are a lot of things that still remain to be done. And one of them I'd love to just mention is the 21st Century Glass-Steagall Act, yeah. Which has been talked on the election a lot about, oh, well, that wasn't the problem and that wouldn't help. But these institutions are so large that we need to come at them from many different approaches. And I think the 21st Century Glass-Steagall Act would be an important step for a couple of reasons. One, you sort of split the banks up into the from the commercial side and then the investment banking side, which are two very different businesses. And
yeah,
as someone
radically.
Who used to work at Merrill Lynch and then was at Merrill Lynch when it was bought by Bank of America, they're not just two different business lines, they're two different cultures. And no one at Merrill Lynch, you know, liked the Bank of America folks. No one at Bank of America liked the Merrill Lynch folks. You know what I mean? Like the Bank of America folks, that the Merrill Lynch folks were too cavalier and like risky. And the Merrill Lynch folks thought the Bank of America people were too stodgy and boring. And it's sort of like a forced marriage that really like needs to end in divorce.
And when an investment bank and a basically a vanilla bank, a commercial bank merge, it's the investment culture that seems to
That's
win
right.
out.
That's right. And so
the risky
I think
investment culture.
And there's a lot in the new version of this bill. So it isn't just your 1930s bill, but I just did an event over at Brandeis University and as a part of it wrote an essay on Justice Brandeis and learned a lot about him and a lot about the book that he wrote that kind of, I think, made the first Glass-Steagall happen, Other People's Money. But his sort of theory is like nothing should be so big that it can control the entire economy, and any sort of chunk that we can take to get rid of the power of these institutions to, and this is what Brandeis said, I'm quoting him, dominate the state will help ensure right. that we don't have these crises. And I think that the 21st Century Glass-Steagall Act is an important part of that. I think that these parts of Dodd-Frank that we've been talking about that are, you know, not being obeyed or haven't even been written are an important part of that. But it's sort of like you need to take a lot of different bites out of this apple in order to solve the problem.
Well, and Glass-Steagall was incremental, right? There was Glass-Steagall, but then there were like six different laws
That's
for the
right.
next 6 years. Banking
right.
reform was an incremental process. And
right.
we tried to throw so much into the Dodd-Frank kitchen and sink all at once, and there are still holes, because who can possibly write that much legislation and get it through in one fell swoop? It's not realistic. It's not
but
possible.
Doesn't it, and don't you think though that I feel like the only chance we have is at these crisis moments because of the entrenched
oh, yeah.
power? And so sometimes, like everyone, I think the reason they tried to throw everything in the kitchen sink into it is because they felt like this was the moment and this is our only chance.
Yeah,
but
I
like
think
hopefully.
That's right, but
Yeah, but I totally agree with you, and absolutely Glass-Steagall wasn't the only thing that happened. And I guess the challenge is, how can we raise enough political pressure in order to continue to advance and fill some of these gaps that you've been pointing out?
So, speaking of gaps, I called senators, I wrote letters, I generally made an enormous amount of noise, including on Netroots Radio Air, when the Cromnibus was passed with the inclusion of the repeal of the swaps pushout rule. And I've already explained in this broadcast to our folks what swaps pushout means, but as best I can tell, that remains an enormous, massive, gaping hole in the side of the ship of the U.S. economy. Yep. Is any progress being made on that? Is FSOC clear that it simply must, it absolutely must be reinstated? And is there a way within, here's my real question, is there a way within existing rulemaking and enforcement that we can essentially stretch out what we've already got to sort of cover that temporary legislative hole until we can fill it?
Well, that presumes that the regulators want to fill the hole, and I don't actually know that that's the case. I think you can always stretch the limits of regulation in order to do what you want. I mean, I don't have a particular theory or prescription for achieving what you're asking. I think that perhaps you could achieve it through margin rules and trying to, for example, make it less appealing to hold derivatives inside the bank versus outside the bank. Like, perhaps there's some regulatory change that could be made there.
Isn't that what Neil Kashari, the new president at Minneapolis Fed, isn't that what he's talking about?
When he's talking about the fact that we need to break up. I mean, yes, you can use capital, you can use margin, you can make things less palatable or more palatable. So I think the short answer to your question is yes. But the main thing I want to say is I don't actually think that the regulators agree that getting rid of swaps push out was a bad thing. I think that there was disagreement among the regulators. The Fed had made it pretty clear for a long time publicly that they did not like the push out provision. Maybe I'm being a little too, like, they were throwing shade, if you know that expression.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe they weren't being absolutely explicit that they didn't like it, but it was clear if you like read the tea leaves that they didn't like it. Whereas I think other regulators did think it was important. So it's sort of like we had to get past that before we could even hope to achieve using existing regulation. But I take your point, because during the crisis, the Fed stretched their authority to the limit, arguably past the limit, in order to provide huge amounts of emergency lending to failing institutions, way over and above the $700 billion in TARP money. I think it was like $1.2 trillion was the highest moment of their emergency lending, which we only know about due to the great heroic work of the Bloomberg News team, who sued the Fed in order to get their FOIA through to find out all about that emergency lending.
Fed loaned to cover payroll at some, you know, at some major corporations who just literally had no access to their money because the financial system, part of the financial system, was locked up and they couldn't roll over their paper. Essentially, they couldn't roll over their securities. Therefore, they couldn't pull payroll out.
It's crazy. I'm obsessed with this. I mean, they loan to Caterpillar. They loan foreign banks. If people haven't seen this, Bloomberg created a great visualization, which I created a short link for because I'm so obsessed with this story, even though it's an old story. It's bit.ly/secret-loans, and it's just a short link to their graphic that they made about it, which you can kind of look through and see all the different companies that were not banks, that were not even U.S. banks, that the government loaned money to.
Yeah, that's what my book is about, actually. So the Fed did remarkable things during that week. I mean, that sort of 10-day period of time was a really astonishing thing in our financial system.
So your point is well taken. You can stretch regulation to the limits if you want to. I question whether or not they want to do that at this moment for what you're advancing, but maybe that will change.
And I kind of see a change in culture happening at the Fed, actually. And I think, from my read, it is starting at the top. It is starting at Yellen. And the reason for that would be she's a Berkeley-educated unemployment expert. That's where her background comes from, as opposed to being a Harvard-educated inflation expert. She's in the other side of the Fed's, you know, responsibility grouping. And for somebody like Kashari to have been elected up at Minneapolis, that's a pretty dramatic leap for Fed to have brought in somebody like that. So I'm kind of thinking that when they have the, as they have the opportunity, that we're seeing a reduction in conservative members of Fed and seeing some more flexible, or maybe, I don't want to say liberal because that word will never, ever, ever be associated with the Fed, but people who are thinking about money in a different way, I guess, at the Fed than we've seen in the past. And of course, nothing really moves at the Fed until you change the president of the New York Fed. But that's, I guess, you know.
It is interesting because I do feel like this is actually bipartisan. Like Kashkari is a Republican, you know, right. Honing over at the FDIC is a Republican. I mean, Sheila Bair was the only one during the financial crisis trying to nationalize Citigroup. She's a Republican. So it is interesting. There is some bipartisan consensus to be had on this issue of how do we address too big to fail in a meaningful way. It's rare, but it happens.
While we're on the topic of the Fed, I remember from Occupy Wall Street, a lot of people were talking about let's audit the Fed. And I hear that from Republicans in Congress. I hear that from libertarians. What's your opinion on that kind of slogan?
I sympathize with calls for transparency. I don't know that that is the linchpin, or maybe that's the wrong word. I just don't know that that's the key to unlocking this. I think it's certainly, you know, there are a lot of institutions where we could use more transparency, but there are a lot of regulators, not just the Fed, that have enormous power. Some of them we never talk about and most people don't even know exist. The Office of the Comptroller for the Currency, or the OCC, examine banks too. And we very, very rarely talk about them. And they're a huge part of the reason, in my opinion, why the foreclosure crisis was so bad, because they essentially preempted state law in some of their regulatory decisions. And states like North Carolina and Georgia that were fighting for strong, you know, anti-predatory lending laws, some decisions by the OCC essentially preempted that state law and made the weaker federal standard win, essentially. So I appreciate the calls for transparency. I perhaps wish that people would focus more on other regulators, not just the Fed.
I do absolutely agree with that. We are out of time here on Hopping Mad. I want to thank Alexis Goldstein for joining us here today. And please find us on Stitcher and iTunes if you want the full interview. There's a lot more coming in our Extra Mad. Stay tuned to Netroots Radio for KGRO in the Morning with David Waldman. You co-authored, and I said this in your introduction, a 325-page comment to the SEC pushing for strong implementation of the Volcker Rule. How close did you get?
Well, we asked for a lot of things. We even, I believe in the comment letter, said that market making didn't really belong in banking. So we certainly did not get that. But well, I think that there were some suggestions that we made. We were certainly, you know, very heavily cited in the final rule, which makes sense because it was a very long letter. But I think we made, you know, a few important changes. But I'm more concerned about actual implementation and enforcement of the Volcker Rule. And the place I am at, working at Americans for Financial Reform, we actually wrote a letter to all of the regulators raising concerns about whether or not the rule is actually being implemented, and calling for more transparency into both the metrics that they're gathering and the enforcement actions that they've taken or not taken. We want to know if they've taken any. Because if you look at trading revenues over the time that banks either knew the Volcker Rule was coming or since it's been implemented, they haven't really changed much. And we don't know if that's because the banks have shifted all of what was previously proprietary trading or, you know, gambling into serving customers, or if they just haven't done anything at all and they're just, it's business as usual. So my concern is actually whether or not the rule is, you know, we deserve any credit for making the rule stronger. I'm actually concerned that the rule isn't
happening at all.
Well, I guess I don't know. We don't know. We don't have the information to know whether or not it is. So we're pushing right now to regulators to let us know.
As I read Dodd-Frank, there are things that I guess I don't know if they've happened. Things like the SEC was mandated to complete a ton of studies. I don't know how the Dodd-Frank actually imagined that the SEC could complete all of the studies that were mandated as quickly as was directed, but the SEC was mandated to complete this massive number of studies, all of which seemed valuable to me, it was a lot. And one of the things they were supposed to do was to evaluate gaps in investor protections. Has that study been completed? And I have the same question about the study and the new rulemaking they were supposed to be doing on short selling.
So believe it or not, I don't know everything there is to know about Dodd-Frank. So I actually don't know the answer to those questions. I do know that the SEC is behind on other rules, like the executive pay rule and the clearing of credit default swaps. But I don't know the answer to your question about this study.
So the executive pay, I know that Elizabeth Warren and Mary Jo White, chairman of SEC, have gone around and around and around and around. These are not buddies. They're not on each other's Christmas cards Christmas card lists. And is it my imagination, or is Mary Jo White a complete disaster?
Well, there are certainly groups that would say that. There's been a lot of, I think, activism around that. I think Root Strikers, for example, is an organization that, I believe it was Root Strikers, that was actually had a mobile truck that was driving around DC saying, you know, we need Mary Jo White to do better. I absolutely think that there have been some frustrating things out of the SEC lately. I think that we've seen a lot of interesting stuff out of Commissioner Kara Stein, where she's been dissenting and pushing. So there's this whole waiver process where essentially if a bank breaks the law and is convicted of a crime, there's automatic penalties that are supposed to kick in. And a lot of them are, you know, things like it's harder for you to raise money because there's a certain seal of approval that you can get as a bank or a financial institution called a well-known seasoned issuer. And I call that WICSI for short because I'm a bank dork. But that's one of the things that is supposed to be revoked if you break the law. And usually what happened in the past is that these waivers were given by SEC staff.
To everybody and their dog.
Exactly.
Seriously, my house rabbit could get a WICSI.
And there are other things that can be taken away from banks when they break the law. The WICSI status is just one of them. And so Commissioner Kara Stein had kind of made this an issue and did some speeches about it and wrote about it and basically said, no, we as commissioners should be voting on these. And in some of those votes, we've seen Mary Jo White voting to give the waiver over the dissent of Commissioner Stein. And so that's that's one example, I think, where she's... And another example is I know there are a lot of rules like executive pay, Section 956.
Yeah.
And then there's one that people have just been petitioning the SEC for a really long time that is not a part of Dodd-Frank that also hasn't moved under Chair White, which was... about companies disclosing political contributions. And I guess the main thing that I have spoken about, I should say, in the past and written about is that Chair White has said that she wanted to take a broken windows policing style approach to the SEC. And I imagine your listeners are probably aware,
but
just in case if they're not, right, that's kind of the way that New York City tried to police its populace for a really long time, right? Like, let's go after the subway dancer. Let's go after the person jumping a turnstile instead of like the white collar criminals or like even the maybe, you know, more organized crime in the city.
We wouldn't want to ruffle Jamie Dimon's here.
Exactly. So Chair White has embraced that, wrote a speech about it. And that is, in a way, what I feel I have seen in the enforcement in the SEC is they go after these small fry, admittedly probably crooked brokers, but they're very small bad actors. They're not the big bad actors. So that would probably be my primary criticism of the SEC and Chair White is the enforcement we've seen are small, teeny, tiny players, and we don't see them going after large institutions.
Kind of in contrast to that, I look at the CFTC under Gary Gensler, and I see that as kind of like a rock star situation. You might have a similar or different perspective because you know more about this sort of thing than I do. What is your opinion of the CFTC, both under Gensler and after he's left?
So Gensler... I think the best way to describe Gensler is to quote one of the other CFTC commissioners and who basically said that they'd never seen anything like it. Gensler's name was like a four-letter word to bankers. It was like a swear word. Gensler used to work at Goldman Sachs. He was also a part of the Treasury Department. But he really made it his mission to fight very, very hard on some very important things, such as cross-border and the treatment of what's essentially like when there is a question about where a particular financial product is traded, right? If you have a London office and a U.S. office and one person's in London and one person's in the U.S. and whose rules apply, the way that we refer to that is cross-border. Yeah. Gensler pushed really, really hard to make sure that as much as possible the U.S. rules applied if there was even, if there was U.S. involvement. And I think that there was a lot of other things that Gensler pushed really hard for and the CFTC under Gensler pushed hard for. We haven't seen the same level of, say, reformist approach under Massad, who's the current commissioner. Mm-hmm. One example that I will give you that has been frustrating for us at Americans for Financial Reform, and it takes a minute to explain, but if there's a new thing that came out of Dodd-Frank called SEFs, Swap Execution Facilities, and it's kind of like an exchange for certain financial products called swaps.
Yeah, I had just explained that to people in the broadcast.
So there's a problem right now where the big dealer banks are kind of trying to keep some of the smaller financial institutions and hedge funds out of some of what are called the screens, which are essentially, the place where you can go to see what is trading on the SEF.
The Bloomberg terminal for
kind SEFs. Of, yeah. And essentially what's been happening is the dealer banks have been, so once your SEF clears, you don't really need to know who you traded with because there's a clearinghouse that's assuming the risk. So it doesn't matter if I traded with JP Morgan or Morgan Stanley or a hedge fund because I don't really need to know who my counterparty was because it's being cleared. Well, what's been happening is the dealer banks have been pressuring some of the SEF operators to give what's called give up, but essentially tell them who was on the other side at the end. And the reason they're doing that is they're trying to find out which hedge funds are trying to get access to these screens and then trying to get the SEF providers to pressure them and so that they can then go to the hedge funds and say, no, you need to get out of this business. This is my business. I'm a cartel. I want to stay a cartel. We don't want you in here. And so hedge funds actually have been pressuring the commission, the CFTC, to make sure that the SEFs don't do this, that they don't give up the name at the end, because it's creating this really terrible anti-competitive situation. And the CFTC has not acted and has decided that it is not, so far it seems that they've decided it's not a problem. So yeah. it's a pretty interesting contrast, I think, between the two administrations over there at the CFTC.
So we went from a rock star to somebody who's just another seat warmer. How do we find more Genslers and put them in places where they will actually regulate?
I mean, this is perhaps cynical, but I feel like sometimes the people that are the best reformers, people don't even know they're reformers until they get there. I think typically people who get positions of power get them because people think that they'll be a bit milquetoast. I know that's kind of a dark view, but that's my personal opinion, I should say, not my employer's opinion.
Well, I think it's hard to get through the Senate, certainly the current mm-hmm. Senate. Now, mm-hmm. if you have any kind of strong opinion that the GOP can strike at in any way, can you, speaking of the CFTC and all the issues, I know that it took a long time after Dodd-Frank and the CFTC was supposed to be putting in place a number of new rules as a result of Dodd-Frank, but they ran up kind of against Basel III. And there were negotiations that had to be finished, international negotiations that had to be finished, and the CFTC had to rewrite some rules based on Basel III, that sort of thing. Can you tell us anything? Are you in the know about how things are going in terms of the international process? Because I look at the big debate that's going on in the UK right now about ring fencing, same thing in the, you know, the Eurozone as a whole. They're talking a great deal about ring fencing, and sort of our phrase for ring fencing in the U.S. is the Volcker Rule, but can you tell us anything about how the sort of international cooperation or lack thereof is affecting implementation of Dodd-Frank?
I mean, a lot of it comes down to race to the bottom, really.
Uh-huh.
And what we find problematic when we talk about this international stuff is, in a lot of the derivatives rules, the U.S. moved first and was more aggressive. And so in a lot of debates, the sort of international harmonization line is deployed as a way to try to get around the U.S. derivatives rules. I certainly think that there has been some progress, especially around capital and margin. But I think that by and large, with the exception, I would say, of the financial transaction tax, where Europe, I think, is very much ahead of the United States and is having a serious conversation about whether or not, you know, they want to have some sort of coordinated financial transaction tax. And by the way, the UK has had one for decades.
Yes.
They have a 50 basis point stamp tax only on buyers of stocks.
And we see how that's crushed the very life out of the City of London, right?
Right. It's booming. It is yeah. booming. And it's been booming. And everyone trades stock there. And nobody, you know, people very much want to participate in the London Stock Exchange still. But
well, and I think that's indicative of, you know, we listen to these people saying, no, no, you know, crying wolf, essentially, mm-hmm. and talking about things like, if we trade derivatives, if we trade swaps on any kind of exchange, fees are going to go up. No, fees, you trade swaps in the light of day and suddenly you've created a competitive environment and swaps fees, you know, the associated brokerage fees fall like mad because they're competing in the light of day.
And did you see that Bank of England report that said as much?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm
yeah.
a wonk, you know, I run around out in the weeds all the time. But it is, I mean, I don't, honestly, why does somebody have to do a report on that? I'm in manufacturing. I could have told them that was going to happen without, I mean, every company in the U.S. understands that if you compete in the light of day, you compete. I don't understand. It's the basis of capitalism, I believe.
I know, it's interesting, but the Wall Street, this has been happening since like 1998. I mean, in 1998, there was this company called Intervest that tried to make the bond market electronic by providing a platform through the Bloomberg terminal where you could electronically trade bonds. Essentially, all the dealers like colluded and, you know, like linked arms and pressured Bloomberg to kick Intervest off of the terminal. And, you know, they ended up suing and pretty much everyone settled except for a couple of people, which is the only reason why we even know about this. But this is just a longstanding problem, is that why, you know, it's rent seeking, right? Why would the dealer banks give up their cartel willingly. They don't actually care about efficiency and transparency and, you know, getting the right price, but that is the argument that they deploy. And that is why I do think it is very important that the Bank of England wrote that report about CEFs lowering prices, because we contend all day long with people saying, no, 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 the poor grandma or the poor farmer or the poor grandma farmer will suffer increased prices because of, you know, financial regulation. And it's just not true.
And what I loved most, actually, about that report was that Financial Times and Guardian and, you know, all of those guys came out and said, of course, this is entirely obvious. And they provided a huge amount of press around. In other words, they shined a bright light on that report as opposed to, you know, burying it in the back of a closet somewhere underneath their dirty laundry.
Mm-hmm.
They made it shine. And I thought that was as valuable as the report itself.
I think that's right. Because it's such a tired talking point, but it gets deployed constantly. Like, oh, if you try to force this onto an exchange, then customers will suffer because they won't be able to get their fancy bespoke derivative that we overcharge them for all day long.
Like, yeah, exactly.
what they need so badly.
So yeah. The SEC is supposed to be putting in place the Merkley provision, rules to prevent future conflicts of interest.
Yes.
So that insurers of a new security can't essentially, I don't know, they can't shop jurisdictions. You know, if it was law enforcement, you'd be talking about them shopping, or a lawsuit, you'd be talking about them shopping jurisdictions for the best judge they can find. Essentially, this is the financial equivalent of that, shopping for the most favorable ratings agencies. And I really laid into ratings agencies hard last week and talked about them at great length. So what's being done with that? Those new rules were supposed to be completed, and this cracks me up, 270 days from mm-hmm. Dodd-Frank implementation. Mm-hmm. They're not done yet, are they?
Nope.
Almost 6 years later?
That's a really good question, and it is a question that we have as well over at AFR, and it's something that we have been asking the commission about, and I don't know that we have a good answer, but you're absolutely right. It is unfinished, and it is interesting because it's one of those provisions, I think, that's particularly easy to understand. I mean, and has been popularized. Like, you think back to the hearings in the Senate, where many, many senators were swearing over and over again because they were reading quotes from Goldman Sachs emails. Yes, shitty deal. And, you know, Dodd-Frank is a part of Obama's legacy, and you would think that it would behoove him, or he would be interested in pressuring the chair of the commission to finish the rules before time is up, because who knows what the next administration is going to be. I mean, I don't think a Trump administration is going to be interested in securitization conflict of interest. Maybe I'm wrong. But
no, I think we can safely bet on that.
Yeah. The short answer is it hasn't moved, and we're trying to make it move.
It's kind of my thinking is that really, if we could beat ratings agencies into submission, in other words, if we could solve all of the problems at ratings agencies, that almost takes care of a lot of other things, because by having a legitimate voice in the middle of all these deals, you know, providing ratings, it protects investors. It creates a level, a playing field between securities, securitizers. It creates, it provides for a lot of things. It's the grease on the wheel and on the gear. And if I was as an advocate, an activist, to me, this is the thing we ought to be leaning on, because it gets us to legitimate ratings.
Yes, I think that it's certainly a part of it. I guess I would also raise, and I don't even say this necessarily to disagree, just something to flag and think about, is that investors, like, think about what happened in the wake of the financial crisis with the mortgage-backed securities market. Like, that market has not recovered. And the reason that it has not recovered has nothing to do with regulation. The reason it hasn't recovered is because all of the different parties on a mortgage-backed security have been so busy suing each other,
right?
Because the incentives were so bad, right? Because you would have a trustee who is supposed to be the person overseeing the product and making sure that, you know, investors were getting their money's worth. And instead, instead, they were just letting the servicer push people into foreclosure or slow walk people into foreclosure because they could rack up fees along the way, and the servicer didn't have any skin in the game. And so I think that credit ratings certainly are a part of it, but I also think that investors, like market participants, have been asking the SEC and others to just clean up the mess of all of these securitizations through the powers that they have to do that. And I don't think that they've done it. So I think that credit ratings would go a long way, but I also think there are other pieces to the puzzle. But yes, as activists, is that a fight we want to have? Probably not, right? Because it's about investors feeling safe to invest in these giant products. So, you know, that's certainly not a fight for activists. But anyway, that's just something that came to mind as you were talking through that.
Now to completely jump someplace else totally different, what's going on in regulation for regional, midsize, and community banks? Because I know that's a really touchy, difficult subject in comparison to a lot of these other things, mm-hmm. which are, you know, at this very high level, what's going on for regional and mid-sized banks, that's sort of like a whole different bucket of
problems. That's a great question. So number one, the short answer is for community banks is nothing, because for the most part, community banks are exempt from Dodd-Frank. They're certainly exempt from CFPB enforcement and supervision if they're under $10 billion.
Not to interrupt here, but as a manufacturer, small business manufacturer, I do business directly with great community banks. And one of the things that's absolutely true about them is that they hold their own loans. Therefore, they have no reason to offset risk. They have every impetus to understand risk to a great degree and invest accordingly.
Yep. I will say, though, that community banks are being deployed as kind of like a PR human shield at the moment in order to advance some reforms for the mid-size and regional banks that you mentioned. So there was a big fight in the Senate last spring, where the chairman of the banking committee, committee, Senator Richard Shelby.
No, they're a community. They're their own life form.
Yeah, he was trying with the Republican caucus there to force through a huge amount of changes to essentially let big regional banks, so not the JP Morgans of the world, but the like PNCs of the world or Capital One of the world, essentially roll back some of the Dodd-Frank regulations and impede the power of FSOC, which is, I imagine you probably talked about, to regulate these regional banks. And so there was a big fight. It didn't actually end up going anywhere, but there has been a lot of sort of political pressure that's been applied from the Republican side, and to some extent I think that there was a lot of fear that the Democrats would be a part of that, but Senator Sherrod Brown, to his great credit, had a Democratic alternative to the Shelby bill, which really did just give relief, some modest relief, to just community banks and not to these big regional banks. Yeah. And so there's been a lot of ink spilled about it and a lot of fighting, but no actual legislation to the extent that I'm aware that's particularly significant to change anything. But it's a big fight that continues to happen. But if folks are interested, Americans for Financial Reform, where I work, we put out a quick little two-pager about community banks that are alive and well under Dodd-Frank with a little bit of data about their profitability. So their earnings are up, their lending growth is strong, and it's exceeding the rest of the industry. Total loans made by community banks have grown over 8% over the last 2 years, which is much higher than non-community banks, who have only seen about a 5% increase. So they're doing quite well, but that doesn't mean that they're not being used as an excuse to push through changes that are actually for pretty big regional banks.
It was interesting. I am shopping for banks right now. We're going through a big growth spurt and I'm shopping for banks. So I talked to 6 different community banks in the last couple of weeks, and I think in almost all of those conversations, as I'm interviewing banks, I ask them about Dodd-Frank, just, you know, because it's on my mind. And all of them, everybody I asked said, Dodd-Frank is great. We need more of that. And I, you know, it's like, looking into the face of bankers and thinking, I'm sorry, are you speaking the same language that I'm speaking? But right. They're community bankers. And what they want to see, what they all basically said in one way or another, is that we want our customers to be able to trust the banking system. And, you know, the global financial crisis has made that very, very difficult. And anything you can do to drive trust back into the banking system is good for us. So therefore, we support Dodd-Frank.
Yep.
So basically, there's a big movement then to make banking boring again.
Yeah. From the little boring guys who are, frankly, thriving in this environment, just as you just said. So I support comes from interesting places. And I always look for ways that advocates can reach out to constituencies they don't realize that they actually have. And it would be really interesting for, you know, Americans for Financial Reform to reach out to community bankers, I think, and get community bankers in the same, you know, on the same bus, because you're trying to get to the same place.
Well, we do sometimes work with the ICBA, the Community Bankers Association, run by Cam Fine. Sometimes, though, we disagree. So, for example, in this Shelby bill that I was just talking about, they did have the support of the ICBA. We disagreed with him about the Shelby bill being for community banks. Just to give you one specific example, like in the Shelby bill, there was a section that would exempt all mortgages that were held by the bank, so held in portfolio, so they sit on it, they don't securitize it, from Dodd-Frank's ability to pay rules that were essentially the rules that made sure that we weren't giving out predatory loans and giving people loans that they had absolutely no ability to actually repay based on their income.
Yeah, the QM rule.
And so, right. So this would exempt all mortgages that were held in portfolio from that, not just for community banks, but for everyone. So the main beneficiary of that would be JPMorgan Chase and Bank of America, not community banks. So we do talk with ICBA. We don't always see eye to eye, and sometimes we have some arguments about, you know, is this bill really for community banks or is this bill really for JP Morgan?
Yeah. So I watched on YouTube the 5-year anniversary event that Americans for Financial Reform held, and I particularly liked the panel on with the regulators. You know, it was five different regulators that were there and speaking about for their agencies, representing their agencies. And the guy from FSOC talked about something that it had never occurred to me, but I thought was really an interesting point, and I wanted to hear your thoughts on it. He said that it took FSOC longer than anticipated, basically, to get up and running because they needed to put in place a number of tools just for the regulators to be able to talk amongst themselves, because one of the things that was clear under Dodd-Frank and clear to anybody who was paying attention was that regulators had no actual formal mechanism for coordinating, talking amongst themselves. Regulators had no way to coordinate their efforts, essentially. And so it took FSOC a period of time just to get that done. Mm-hmm. To me, though it took FSOC longer to get up and running than any of us would have liked, I think having spent time up front to get that piece right was probably really smart. And have they done that as well as he seemed to be saying, or is he a really good PR guy?
I mean, absolutely. I think that the regulators are talking more now than they were prior to Dodd-Frank. I think, you know, we have more memorandum of understandings or MOUs than we had previously. I do think, though, that work remains to be done. And I think one of the great hopes that I had after Dodd-Frank was that the Office of Financial Research could kind of serve as a centralized place and maybe a place where information sharing could happen across the regulators. And it doesn't appear to be happening, but they are certainly, I think, talking, and in some ways that's because they're forced to, both through FSOC, but also through rules like the Volcker Rule, where they have joint authority and a joint remit to implement it and enforce it. But I think that in some ways it's a case-by-case basis. But I would agree with your optimism that at least the formation of FSOC forced them to do a lot of coordinating that previously probably wasn't happening to the extent that it's happening now. But I don't know that I would say that it's happening across every area that it should be happening.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, that's logical. That makes sense to me. I just have a couple more questions, but one of them is just a complete what? Is there really still no regulator for the kith and kin of insurance, of AEG, of insurance, AIG insurance companies? It seems to me like in putting Dodd-Frank in place, shouldn't insurance companies have risen to the top, you know, to a top place of concern based on the complete freaking disaster of AIG?
Well, there is an insurance regulator on the FSOC committee, but I think that there hasn't really been a solution for, say, the credit default swap problem, right? Yeah. Where it's a product that probably should be regulated like insurance and isn't. And I think that that remains a problem that Dodd-Frank, to the extent that I'm aware, didn't really solve very well. And I think that there is some renewed interest in, you know, lawmakers and advocates to, is this the moment, right, that we push on this? Because we have this election moment where Wall Street keeps coming up. The public seems to be very interested. But yes, I don't have a good explanation as to why credit default swaps haven't received more scrutiny than they have. They certainly have gotten some under some of the derivatives rules, but I think that it may not even be that they're the next problem in the next financial crisis, right? I think it probably will be a new product. And have we done all we can to make sure that there isn't another emerging product that exists in some regulatory black hole? Like, I don't know that we have.
It's interesting. I mean, Glass-Steagall, 1933 Glass-Steagall happens and it puts a wall between commercial and investment banking, but it was all the way to 1956 before you get the Bank Holding Act.
Holding company,
before you put a wall between banks and insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd think that once we, you know, figure that out, we would have figured that out, but no.
Well, there was the quiet metamorphosis, right? That Sally Omarova talks about in her paper about... And again, this goes back to that regulator I was talking about, the OCC. I mean, that's less about insurance and more about derivatives and how banks were slowly able to start to trade derivatives. But absolutely. And, you know, Graham Leach Bliley just kind of blasted that whole separation. But, and again, this is apologies, a tangent to your question, but it also makes me think of bank dealing in physical commodities, which is another thing that Professor Omarova has written about in her paper, The Merchants of Wall Street. And so there were so many different ways that this concept of boring banking that we talked about earlier has just been eroded and eroded and eroded through all these sort of shadowy decisions by regulators to let them do it. Well, maybe not all shadowy, right? Graham Leach Bliley was pretty overt and out in the open, but there were lots of decisions by the OCC to let banks start to do derivatives. There were lots of decisions by, I think, the Fed to let banks do physical commodity involvement. Then you had legislation to let them, you know, merge with insurance companies. And so all these different combinations of things created this terrible perfect storm to allow these giant supermarket financial institutions to form.
And I, you know, when I think about banks owning water,
yeah,
if you want to get scared, you know, banks owning wheat and banks owning water are pretty, those are pretty terrifying things.
Well,
actually.
And not just owning, but then trading, right? Because the whole reason that they're able to get the authority to conduct physical commodity operations is that they argue that it is a complementary activity with their trading operations. The Fed did, I should say, put out what's called an ANPR, I think is what it was. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was just a request for information. They put out something last year. It might have even been two years ago.
No, I think it was last year.
Saying, talk to us a little bit about physical commodities and banks operating in them. And
kind of like they were starting to think about maybe that wasn't the best idea ever.
Yeah. And I haven't seen any follow up, but, you know, I remain hopeful that there will be. I don't think that they put that out just as a one-off.
Casually, yeah, I think you're right about that. So just to wind up, and actually you can switch this to almost any question you would like, but I just wanted to give people an example of the density and complexity of Dodd-Frank. So I was going to ask you, what is the equity-indexed annuity oversight loophole, which, you know, I can hardly even say, and only because it's written down in front of me, but... You know, you don't have to answer that. You can just give me any example of just ridiculous density. But I think it's helpful for people to understand that this piece of legislation is no small thing. This piece of legislation is right up there with the ACA in terms of, you know, absolute, you know, almost impenetrable density?
Well, it's a hard question because I don't know what the best example is, but I find that I need 5 minutes to try to summarize Dodd-Frank because there's so many different buckets. I will say, though, that there is one bucket that I think is working very well, which is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is a bucket of Dodd-Frank. And, you know, they've returned over $11 billion to over 25 million Americans scammed by their financial companies. But yeah, there's the CFPB bucket. There's the derivatives bucket. There's the whole what happens when a bank fails bucket. There's transparency rules. There's conflict of interest rules, like you mentioned. There's just so it's, you know, I don't know the total page count. Maybe you do, but it is a long bill. There's a lot in it. A lot of it is important. A lot of it is undone. It is certainly not what Chairman of the House Financial Services Committee called regulatory waterboarding in a recent hearing, which is interesting because I don't know if Jeb Hensarling has an opinion on waterboarding generally. This makes it seem like he thinks it's a bad thing, which I didn't know that was his opinion.
Waterboarding perfectly fine, but financial waterboarding, very, very bad.
But yes, it is a very long law. There's a lot in it, and in spite of it being so long, there is so much that it doesn't address, and we need to, you know, complete the work of the unfinished work of financial reform. So well, I'm afraid I don't have a good example. Maybe you can outline that loophole as a good example.
Love is that, you know, when they knew something needed to have new rules and they were concerned about something in the legislation, they just got to a point and said, okay, so this is a bad thing and it needs to be fixed and the SEC needs to do a study and come up with rules. And it would be like this little short paragraph for a thing that's going to take 5 years to write the rules on and, you know, 120 people and hearings and, you know, it's going to be a massive production. And they do it in this little short and, you know, they'll do a study and write rules.
Right. I will say, though, that the reason for that, I wouldn't blame Congress for that. I would blame the industry for that. Because generally, if they don't do a very thorough study, and the CFPB, I think, is probably going to come up against this perhaps, the industry will sue over the rule. And they'll sue anyway. But the study, I think regulators see that as a way to lay out the case to allow themselves to defend rules in court that they know the industry is going to sue over.
Yeah.
To try to get, you know, overturned, which happens sometimes. Parts of Dodd-Frank have already been overturned. There was a part of Dodd-Frank called the proxy access rule that basically was supposed to give people that didn't have the resources to show up at a shareholder meeting the ability to nominate new members of the board, right? Because if you're someone who has one share of a stock and you're not wealthy, you're probably not going to fly to the shareholder meeting. So why can't you nominate a new member of the board through the paper proxy that they mail out? And that rule was overturned by a lawsuit.
And there goes Arliss Bunny's opportunity to sit on the board of Citibank.
you got to show up at the board meeting.
That's right. In my ears and tail and the whole. Yeah. Anyway, well, thank you so much, Alexis, for joining us today. I really appreciate your time and your expertise. This has been just fabulous. And you're welcome back anytime. Anytime you think you want to come and talk to us about something, we would absolutely love to have you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
All right, folks, you've been listening to Hopping Mad. We will catch you next time.